question this morning. Obviously, I have lots of questions, but how many, while growing up, had either parents or grandparents say something like, "You kids have it so easy these days. Why, when I was growing up, I had to," and you can fill in the blank, you know, "walk 6 miles uphill both ways to school in 6 feet of snow, minus 40. In your grandfather's pajamas." Yes, okay, so we have that. And you know, when they said those things, back then you were not allowed to roll your eyes at your elders, but you were doing it on the inside anyway. It's like, oh, here it goes again. And so I've caught myself a few times, you know, but it's more like, "You guys are so lucky. You can watch something at a, you know, a touch of a button." But for us, it was like we had to wait all week to watch a cartoon on TV, and then it was fuzzy. But, you know, so I guess the terms change, but we all have that attitude. But there's no getting away from it that if we didn't start out with a cushy lifestyle. Because I knew if Lou was here, Lou told me that there was quite some interesting stories of his growing up. But we have all adapted to the one that we're in now. We have adapted so much, we don't even think about it. I mean, let's just think about this for a minute. What people 100 years ago would have given. You got water straight from the tap in your own home. You don't have to haul it from the well. It's hot on demand. You don't have to boil anything. The laundry machine, you don't have to do scrub boards if you go back farther or beat your clothes on the rocks. You can actually get milk from a drive-thru. We have grocery stores. So, I mean, our biggest hang-up is that we forgot the bags and we have to pay for plastic bags, but that's the big complaint in a grocery store. We have takeout food that can be delivered to your home if you're not cheap, like I am. I always go out and get them. But still, the fact is, it could be delivered without me ever having to leave home. Ready-made clothes. I mean, my children and husband would look terrible if I was sewing for them, because it's bad. And apparently, my son Daniel has inherited that gift, as Leah has noticed. He went and did a craft session with some elementary teachers the other day, teaching them how to do sock puppets. And Leah said the sock has sort of one eye squinted, you know, kind of like the eye matey. So, sorry, Leah, it came straight from me on that one. But, you hop in a car. You can drive for a couple of hours at a destination that would take a week to walk. We don't think anything of this at all. If you're cold, you turn up the heat with a switch. The remote control. I mean, let's face it. Brian happens to think it's one of man's finest inventions, as long as it's not too complicated for him to run. Nothing he likes better than laying back in a lazy boy chair, with his bag of microwave popcorn, watching a big screen TV with surround sound. Mind you, our boys roll their eyes at how ancient our technology is. But don't forget, he was one of the ones that went uphill, you know, to school 6 miles deep snow, you know. So his ancient technology is ultimate luxury to him at this point. And I'm using him as an example. I mean, I just love being able to kind of mock him a little bit when he's not here. But really what I'm doing is making fun of all of us, because the list is endless when you start thinking about it. We've all been raised in a culture that caters to our needs of comfort. Something I've always warned my kids when they were growing up is that every strength has a weakness and every positive can have a negative to it. The mentality that comes with needing our creature comforts can be detrimental for the advancement of the kingdom. Don't worry, I'm not trying to start a new doctrine while Brian's away, although I did run by him the message to make sure he knew what kind of mess he might have to clean up when he got back. But I'm not suggesting that we go to the monastery convent way of doing life. Matter of fact, another story on Brian, he had to stay at an Anglican convent while going to school. And I was like, how did you get in? Because I thought that was for women, but they, you know, had it so they could pay for an overnight bed and breakfast type thing to help out with finances. But he said, honestly, Pam, he says, I'm not sure if the nuns just weren't mourning people, but the sour looks on their faces at breakfast made me think that maybe there was a negative aspect to living in the convent. So it, you know, it wasn't necessarily the best way either. It just, you know, there's pluses and minuses, but he was glad that he wasn't a nun. I'm saying all this to point out the fact that we do need to be aware of our natural tendencies, or if you want to say weaknesses, we have for being comfortable in this life. Because we have grown up in a comfortable society. This morning I want to talk about the cost of serving for the kingdom of God. It's a subject, believe it or not, that most churches avoid, as frankly people want to sell Jesus as a cheap commodity because you get more sales that way. And it's a concern of church leaders when they've started to notice the lack of understanding the cost of serving. I really appreciated last week when Brian was talking about not rushing people with their decision to follow Christ. I was interested when Dan was saying that the kids in the youth group he works with, he said it used to be everybody had a basic knowledge of God. It was taught in schools, and you know, you had, he says these kids have no knowledge whatsoever, nothing. And he says, how can I get them to a decision to faithfully serve when they haven't had a good look at him? He says, nobody makes that level of commitment without a good look. And so, as I said, I appreciated Brian talking about not rushing people because most of us have sadly watched high-pressured sales techniques used in presenting the gospel. And there has been some dire consequences to it. Jesus never sold himself, and he never sold himself as cheap. He made it very clear about the cost. I remember reading some advice from a turn-of-the-century revival leader, and what he said was, don't try to take the baby out of the womb before they're ready. Because, he said, let the Holy Spirit do the work. In the natural, if babies come out before their time, they either die or are in need of constant medical intervention. In either case, impatience can risk the child's full potential. And we want full potential. We want gold. We're not going for bronze, we're going for gold here. In Luke chapter 14 and verse 28 and 29, I know Leah's going to put this up. I'm going to be reading from the NIV version. But Jesus uses several examples in Luke chapter 14 of the cost of being a disciple, or if you want to say a follower of Christ, because I know years ago when I always heard about disciples, I always thought mentally 12 people. And so really, disciple is about being a follower of Christ. And so Jesus talked about the cost of following. Verse 28. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you. I don't know about you, but I can find this verse a little intimidating. I look at the cost of what some people have had to endure, like the Syrian Christians, and I'll tell you, there's a man who spoke into Brian's in my life, and my jaw dropped because I don't hear all the stuff because they tend to hide it on the news, what has happened to those people. But what they have had to face, that's why they finally broke down and said, this is genocide. The most horrible deaths for some of these people. But when I look at that, I think I'd like to think that I wouldn't crumble under such cost, but I'm not sure if I'm actually strong enough. We all like to think that, but I'm not sure. When we get to that point, though, we have to take a step back, because the strength part comes from Him. It doesn't come from us. He's not actually interested in our strength. He said, I'll be there for you. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to forsake you. Paul said, when I'm weak, He is strong. He says, I am the strength. The joy of the Lord is our strength. He's not looking for our strength, but He's looking for our willingness to go the journey with Him. And I think in those moments that the Syrians have had to face, God has been their strength. They say, I will go through this with you, God. It's a willingness to do what it takes. That's what He's asking. The cost has so often been equated with money. I don't know why it is, but maybe that's how our first go-to. And they use the example of the rich young ruler in Matthew chapter 19, where the young man did not want to give up his comfort of wealth to follow Christ. And I can remember many times that was so hammered in that God doesn't want you to have any wealth at all. And yet I have watched God bless His people when they have been faithful and have done a lot with the wealth. But wealth can be a very dangerous spot to be in, because you can start relying on yourself instead of God. But that was not talking about the wealth necessarily. What He was talking about, the issue was not specifically about money, but rather the man's unwillingness to give up whatever was needed to fully follow after Christ. That was that man's issue. For other people, it's other issues. Jesus did not pressure him to do it. The decision was totally in His hands, the young ruler's hands. If we stayed with the idea that cost is about money, we would miss a much bigger picture. As I actually believe most people in this room, we're not driven by money, because you wouldn't be here. I mean, you'd at least be in a sparkly church or something, you know. The reality is, I believe that most people in this room, we just want to have enough to pay our bills. You know, maybe a little bit extra, but it's not the motivation. And I don't have a problem. I said to my parents one time, I said, for Brian and I personally, money has never motivated us. It's simply a vehicle to get where we need to get to. And that's a healthy way of looking at it. I think I can safely say that most of us here have a great admiration for the people of the early church. I do. Because they literally turned the world upside down. And you listen to a lot of motivational preachers, they're always going back to them as the this is what we would like to be. I want to look at four people from the early church this morning and take a glimpse of what the kingdom cost them. And when I say a glimpse, it's because it's only a little snapshot. There were lots of things that cost them, but I wanted to look at four particular people of the little bit that they had to do. And perhaps some may think they are odd glimpses, but I felt they were the ones to focus in this morning. The first person we're going to look at is Timothy, and I'd like to turn to Acts chapter 16, verses 1 to 3. Acts chapter 16, verses 1 to 3. It's really about the introduction of Timothy on scene here. Starting verse 1 of Acts chapter 16, it says, Paul came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was Jewish, and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. The believers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. I'm not trying to do locker room talk here, but I believe this needs to be looked at. Just imagine to put yourself in this perspective, and it's equal opportunity male and women in this sample here, but just imagine Brian saying, I really feel we need to go and minister to some obscure tribe in the Amazon, but in order for them to receive what we are saying, we need to cut off our right ear, as that is the tribal rule. How many are with me? I would not be standing up. I admit it. I don't have that. God would really have to speak to me on that. Timothy had to endure a lot of physical pain in order to share the gospel. Why? That's a big question for people. If they know their Bible well, Paul was actually the biggest defender of the Gentiles not having to be circumcised to serve God as Christians. Just look at the book of Galatians. So why was it necessary? It was because the Jews in the area would not have received Timothy's gift of ministry without him being circumcised. I underlined here, definitely a cost. The next couple of people I want to look at, and it's Acts chapter 16, verses 16 to 34. And the two people, familiar story, Paul and Silas. I don't know, Paul seems to be in every picture. Maybe he was kind of the one that stirred the pot on everything, but anyway, this is more personally costing Paul. Verse 16 of Acts chapter 16. He said, once when we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a female slave who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune telling. She followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, these men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you to be saved, or showing you the way to be saved. She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so annoyed that he turned around and said to the Spirit, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her. At that moment, the Spirit left her. When her owners realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, these men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for Romans to accept or practice. The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten with rods. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. When he received these orders, he put them into the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Imagine starting a church that way. Suddenly, there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once, all the prison doors flew open and everyone's chains became loose. That to me just sounds like the Holy Spirit. I'm sorry. My picture is that people are in prison and you're singing and praising, and then God shows up and chains are dropped. And so the jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. And for those that don't know, they'd rather kill themselves than be in the hands of the Romans, because if a prisoner escaped, it was much worse for you than dying by killing yourself. So he thought the prisoners had escaped, but Paul shouted, don't harm yourself, we're all here. The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved in your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. And at that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his household were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before him. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God and his whole household. And if you just backtrack for a minute to sort of do an overview of this, Paul and Silas were doing good. And they got kicked in the teeth for it. And I would love to have a very big audience, and I'm not talking about here, but just in general, of the church people. Get over it. You're in a war. I cannot believe the amount of people that come to me, how hurt they are because they were trying to do something good. It's part of the package deal. If you have hurts, and we have all sustained hurts, you have the healer you go to. If you need to get extra help, that's fine. Like to have someone else help you with the experience. But you need to get over it. And so they got kicked in the teeth. They had major pain and discomfort with beating and imprisonment. I mean, think about it. They're beaten with rods. I don't even know what they are, but it sounds painful, just the idea of it. But the question is, how else would they have met the jailer if they had not gone through it? There was a man ready to get saved, because what was the first thing he asked? What must I do to be saved? The baby was ready to come out, just needed the midwife there. I do like, though, because a lot of people stop there, and I love seeing Paul's humanity, because I think he and I would have got along really well. If you want to finish Acts chapter 16, verse 35 to 39. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officers to the jailer with the order, "Release those men." The jailer told Paul, "The magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can leave. Go in peace." But Paul said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we are Roman citizens, and threw us in prison. And now do they want to get rid of us quietly? I don't think so. Let them come and escort us out." The officers reported this to the magistrates, and when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. They came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city. This passage shows us that Paul could have demanded his rights, but he bypassed it because he could have foregone the pain and discomfort. But instead, he chose not to because there was a bigger purpose at hand, even though he didn't know what was going to happen when he got to the prison. But he knew about kingdom. But I have to say, my movie version is a little bit humorous of Paul getting a little bit of satisfaction of having the officials come to the prison to escort him out. And sorry, you know, delete this one, but I'm thinking there's a lot of butt kissing going on here by these officials, having to, "Oh, please, please, don't hold this against us." And there's enough humanity to kind of enjoy being in that position, I think. But anyway, the last person I wanted to look at is Jason. And a lot of people don't know about Jason. He's not really mentioned much, but Acts chapter 17 and verse 4 to 9. And again, this happened to this guy because Paul's hanging around him. He's just a magnet. But Acts chapter 17, verses 4 to 9. Some of the Jews were persuaded, because Paul and Silas have been doing ministry, so they were persuaded to join them, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and quite a few prominent women. But other Jews were jealous, So they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out of the crowd. So originally they were going for Paul and Silas. But, of course, when they got there, they couldn't find them. So they dragged Jason and some other believers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here. And Jason has welcomed them into his house. They are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus." And when they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil. Then they made Jason and the others post bond and let them go. There was financial cost and humiliation. And I was trying to think of how we would feel about this, trying to do modern day picture. But imagine your picture in the paper for a DUI you didn't commit. People have a long memory. That would be humiliating to me. I actually purposely don't read a lot of that stuff because sometimes it's people I know and I just, for their sakes, I don't want to see it. But Jason was doing nothing wrong, but he still had to pay a fee. He still was publicly humiliated. Serving God will cost. There's no way around that. King David, though, we know that God said he was a man after his own heart, was offered by one of his subjects all the sacrifices he needed for free. That's 2 Samuel 24, if you want to look it up at some point. But David's reply was, "I will not give to God what costs me nothing." In other words, if it didn't cost me anything, it isn't worth anything. You have Mary, Lazarus' sister. In John chapter 12, verse 3, she's pouring out expensive perfume on Jesus' feet before his death. And I'm sure, like me, you've heard lots of wonderful sermons from it. But you have Judas, who was motivated by money, was having a heart attack over this because Jesus wasn't worth it. We know that because he sold him for 20 pieces of silver down the road. But it was worth it to Mary. They speculate what this meant, whether it was her dowry, whatever, but it cost high, and she never thought twice about it. Another verse to kind of leave you with is Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 to 46. And Jesus was talking about the kingdom of heaven. In Matthew 13, verse 44 to 46, a lot of people could probably quote this. But Jesus said again, "The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. He cashed in all the RRSPs, he did it all, because that was worth more than anything that he knew of." We say we want the early church days back, but the question of the day is, what is he worth to you? If we went back to the passage in Luke 14 where Jesus was talking about the cost of discipleship, he said salt is good. I actually underlined that in my Bible because I'm so tired of people saying, "Oh, salt's so evil." I love salt. But it says, he said salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness... Have we lost some of our saltiness? I'm not looking at you guys, I'm looking at myself. One final story about the cost, and it's a personal one. There have been a few stories over the years that Brian and I have had, but I want to go to one more recent. And I'm truly sorry if you've heard this before, but it fits well into what I'm trying to say. About a year before Brian was going to school, there wasn't even a blip on the radar of what was about to happen to our lives. It wasn't like this was a lifelong dream or anything. But we had a sense that God was going to do a major course correction in our life plans. Luke, the baby of our family, was about to head off to university and life was going to naturally change for us. But for about a week, I went through a lot of emotional pain with no real explanation for it. I wasn't crying over Luke leaving. Sorry, Luke, but I was doing a happy dance on that one. Nah, there was a little bit of that. But it was so beyond what was within the normal realm, this mourning that was going on. And during that time, God was talking to me. And he was asking me if I was willing to give up my right as a wife to have my husband in my life. And I can tell you, there was a lot of tears. You need to understand something about ministers' wives, because most of you haven't been. And we all have our different views of life, but I'll give you a glimpse of what it's like with a minister's wife. A minister's wife is having to be on the back burner of your husband's life much of the time. It's the nature of the job. I actually say to Brian, I'm always shocked when I sit down with a minister's wife and I start to hear the bitterness and anger that comes out because her husband's time is taken up so much by others. And I try my best to, you know, talk them through some of it. But inside, and thank goodness people can't hear my words inside sometimes, because I'd offend a lot of people. But inside I'm thinking, what did you think you were signing up for? Maybe I knew better because I had lived in a minister's home and my grandfather was a minister. But it's part of the job. It's like a soldier who gets married, his partner needs to know what is the possibility ahead for him or her. There's going to be separation, lots of months of separation perhaps. They're going to move a lot. That person's going to have to be the primary caregiver of the children. They may end up a widow or a widower. They may come back from war with post-traumatic stress disorder and they have to deal with it. Knowing what you got to bring on. It's the role of a soldier's wife or a spouse. But besides being a minister's wife, and as I said, you are on the back burner. It's just part of it. I'm not saying always, but a high percentage. And it's just part of it. But Brian and I were doing what most people were doing, which was raising a family, and a family that was involved in the community. You know, it's kind of a divide and conquer. You go this way, I go that way. Most of you have had experience raising children. There's not a lot of couple time. You know, it's kind of like, okay, guys, go away. We'd like to have some time alone. It doesn't seem to work well that way. So we were looking forward to having the time as a couple. Baby gone, hey, this is great. Because believe it or not, for all the joking and teasing Brian and I do back and forth, we love hanging out together. We are as opposite as all get out. And yet, we are the best of friends. Because God put us well together. So it was hard. But during the week of tears, God had me fill up a travel bag full of travel-sized items. You know, guys, I called it a makeup bag, and Brian really hated it, but it was a shaving kit. And I put, you know, soap and shampoo and toothpaste and sort of things, like you would grab to go away overnight, have everything ready to go. And I don't, at the time, really know why God had me do that, and maybe it was encouraging me by packing the bag that Brian wasn't going to die on me. Because frankly, that's what it felt like inside, that God was saying, you're not going to have him. Whatever was going to happen, I said, okay, God, I don't know. I'm dying inside, but I'm willing. You can have them. After the week of tears, nothing happened. Kind of felt like Jonah sitting out in front of Nineveh waiting for something to happen, destroying. And inside I'm thinking, what the heck was that all about? Because, I mean, it was awful, the pain that I went through. Let's fast forward that a year. A lot of stuff was happening at the same time. Dan was graduating from school. He was getting married. Luke's wedding was in the near future. And God began to burden us that Brian needed to go to school. We had 3 weeks to get his application and interviews done. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but we were both working and, you know, had jobs, extras, all that stuff. So it was huge to try to fit this all in. Because everything was happening so fast, we actually needed to be prepared ahead of time for it. Because there was no time for decisions at that point. The next 3 years was going to be some of the toughest years of my life. And there have been a few of them, actually, over the years. For one thing, I was emotionally alone. And I give you an example to just kind of understand, you know, in a partnership how tough this could be. But Luke was in a car accident. It wasn't his fault, but the car was totaled. And I couldn't even call Brian to let him know. Because he was in the middle of an intensive course he needed really bad, and there were exams he had to write. And I did not dare let him be distracted from it. I'm telling you, that's feeling lonely. And I was hoping I was making the best call because I didn't want him upset with me. But, I mean, Luke still had all his limbs and everything, so I figured we'd get through till Brian was done. But that was tough. Looking back now on it, was it worth it? I'll tell you something. Every time Brian tells me of him being able to help somebody emotionally or spiritually with a victory, people being set free, it was so worth it. Even though I'm not there with him, I'm walking with him every step of the way. God's no man's debtor. There's reward in it. And what he's looking for is willingness. Would I do it all over again? In a heartbeat. So, maybe somebody's saying, Pam, what does this have to do with me? I really feel that it was time of self-examination. And I'm including myself in this, because that's the past now. God, what do you have ahead? Am I willing to give up what my right is to have? Remember Paul. He gave up his right as a Roman citizen in order to meet the jailer. Am I willing to give up whatever my right is to have because he's worth it? That his kingdom is worth it? Brian and I were discussing the other day that it seems like God is stirring up the prophetic gifts that are in me. I've had a lot of things over the years that are similar to the travel bag thing. But it seems like those gifts are being stirred up. And in my heart of hearts, I believe that God is preparing us like he did for me ahead of time with the packing of the travel bag for what's still ahead of us. I don't know the timeline, but I do believe it is coming. We need to be prepared for it by wholeheartedly embracing the concept, God, when you're ready, I'm willing. I'm ready to. I leave you that this morning because I really believe that God, I had to run this through Brian because I just said, Brian, this is a tough subject. And yet when he went through it, he says, Pam, it is time. So I leave that with you. We're going to pray and close. Please, I know Sundays can be distracting by so many things, but take some time and say, God, just check. Am I okay? Am I still willing? And if there's areas that I need to deal with, help me deal with it. Help me to be Timothy and say, okay, Paul, do it. Father, I thank you for this morning. God, I thank you for your words. I thank you that in all the words, your love still pours through. And God, there was no greater price than what you paid. And nothing is even close to that price. But Father, like the rich young ruler, you always gave us a choice. And each turn of the road, there's a choice. So God, we ask as the next turn in the road that you would remind us and gently challenge us to make sure that we are still willing, like Paul and all the people of the early church that went forward. And God, we do invite that time that you are telling us that there is stuff that's going to change and happen. And we ask that you would prepare us ahead of time. And God, that we would not be looking to our own strength, but your strength. And that you would make us willing. We bless you and praise you. I pray for safety in this room. I pray blessing upon the families that are here. In your precious name, amen.